Hi, everybody. My name's Darren. I'm an alcoholic. I felt like royalty just then. Who's speaking again? Oh, yeah. That guy there. I want to thank Mark and Vanessa and the committee for inviting me up to speak and spend the weekend with you guys. I'm looking forward to tomorrow night's speaker and Tammy on Sunday. I know we're all going to have a good time. I want you to know that I am the worst drunk I've ever met. I can't believe I'm sober. I can't believe I'm sober and I'm happy. Those two things don't usually go together, do they? That's why we don't want to get sober. That's why I didn't want to get sober, because sobriety sucks. Sobriety sucks when you don't have a program and you're just flailing in the wind. In fact, being sober is so uncomfortable, so miserable. I'm so restless, irritable, discontent. I get so angry. I feel so disconnected from you. I feel so alone, I pick up a drink again, whether it's a few days or a week. And of course, that sounds obvious to us. When you're new, you might relapse. But if you've just come out of the lockdown psychiatric unit, one more time, the most insane thing you could do would be to pick up a drink. And there I am, all lit up again, because I have no solution. I have no solution to this thing called life. And just refraining from drinking isn't going to cut it for someone like me. And so I'm really glad that when I got here, people were properly armed with the facts about themselves and the illness. And even though I wasn't. You know, I put off coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for the longest time possible, like many of you. I did not want to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, have you seen it on the telly? That's the TV for you over there. Have you seen it on the telly? It sucks big time. It is like the most depressing thing you've ever seen in your life. They always depict it so boringly depressing. It's crazy. It's usually 14 bald, fat, ugly, miserable men in a circle, in a smoky-filled room. One of them might be a week sober or something, and they're all clapping and crying. Like, holy shit, I hope I never end up in that room. And then that's the only place everyone's telling me to go, towards the end of me drinking. I'm like, no, you don't understand, mate. I'm already suicidally depressed. Now you want me to go to that ANA thing? It makes no sense. You're trying to finish me off quicker. I don't understand. I also didn't think I was an alcoholic, but because I don't look like an alcoholic. I don't know about any of you, but before this thing, I had a preconceived notion of what it looks like to be an alcoholic. And it can't really be anybody in this room. You're either too young, you're too beautiful, you're too well put together, or some of you look like you've had a good drink at the back over there, I suppose. But for the most part, you don't look alcoholic, and I didn't look like an alcoholic. But I'll tell you something, when Alcoholics Anonymous is the last house on the block, this thing seems to work just a little bit better. And that was my experience, even though I didn't get it right away, but I eventually got recovery immediately. And you'll hear about that, you know. And, you know, so I remember it well. I'd already made it. I'm from England, of course. Alcohol didn't do this to me. I'm from England, Manchester. I'm not having a stroke or anything, I promise you. You know, and so I remember the moment I was cornered by King Alcohol, quicksand stretched all around me. I was in Santa Barbara. I'm living in a crappy room in a crappy house on the west side of town. There's four of us sharing a house. My room's at the back of the house with its own entrance, thank God, so nobody had to deal with drunken Darren all the time. And it was midnight, and I'm maudlin drunk yet again. The other three guys were downtown partying, having excluded me, of course, which made for more self-pity. And I'd been suicidal on awakening for at least 18 months. On awakening. Oh my God, another day of torture. So as I'm maudlin drunk, I remembered one of them had like an arsenal of weapons in the room, in his bedroom. So I jimmied the door. Well, first of all, I was so bad that I made the call to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how miserable I was. And so I had to get the Yellow Pages out. You youngins will have to Google that, won't you? I got the Yellow Pages out to call Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took me forever to find the name. Darren, it's AA, it's in the beginning of the book. And I called the number, and a lovely older lady answered the phone, and she was so good to me. She was so good at her job, and I got straight down to business. And I said, yes, I might drink too much, but if what's happened to me had happened to you, you'd be drinking like I drink too, lady. And I'm going to kill myself, and I'm going to do this and that. And she'd talk me down off the ledge, and she'd insert some magic every now and then. And then she said to me, hey, well, Darren, have you never been to a meeting? No. Well, Darren, believe it or not, there's a meeting tomorrow night. Not too far from you, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. She made it sound so special, it was unbelievable. I didn't know there was 200 meetings a week in Santa Barbara. And so I passed out. I came to the next late morning, shaking and baking. And I remembered, oh my God, I was supposed to go to this A&A meeting. And there was just nowhere else for me to go. It was over. Now, I can't say I didn't have a little drink. I am physically dependent on vodka at this stage of my drinking. If I'm going to leave my bedroom, let alone my house, I have to have a bit of cheeky vodka, you know what I mean? Especially if I'm going to do something really weird, like interact with another human. So I had a bit of vodka in me. I showered for the first time in months. I gelled my hair all sexy like me and Pat used to be able to back in the day. And I went wandering down to this AA meeting. It was a huge men's stag. There were 80 men outside this meeting hall. And it was nothing like I'd seen on the telly. It was like this. There was a big, well-lit room. There was a vibe about it. Everybody was welcoming. They were all happy to see each other. Someone had gotten promotion at work and they could tell they were all stoked for him. Someone else had gotten recently engaged and they're all happy and high-fiving. Now, I'm not getting involved, of course. I'm sat down because I don't want to catch anything from these happy folks. You know what I mean? I'm an observer. And so, but what happened next really captured my attention. Just underneath, the deadly earnestness began to kick in. The secretary assumed his seat, shuffled his papers, so he meant business. Everybody shut up. Everybody got off their phones, if you can believe it. And they sat in two huge circles all around me. And I'm watching this thing unfold and I'm like, wow, this is amazing. This is crazy. And as the meeting started with some of the readings, I thought, well, this is a good time to open my jacket pocket. I pull out a huge bottle of vodka and start drinking in the meeting. The guy next to me is like, holy shit, this guy's drinking vodka in the meeting. And I was like, wait a minute. Nobody else is drinking. What's going on in here? Don't you have a drinking problem? I have a really bad drinking problem, mate. Isn't this Alcoholics Anonymous? I stayed drunk in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in Santa Barbara for a year. For a year, drinking in the meetings. And most everybody was cool to me. Most everybody was great to me. Keep coming back, Darren. It's all right. Keep coming back. It took me 3 months to figure out what you cheeky monkeys were doing. You lot were putting your vodka in a water bottle, then bringing it to the meeting. You could have told me, bloody hell. But it wasn't always like that. I started drinking in England at 13. 13, I thought Mark's going to fall off his chair here. 13, that's outrageously young, isn't it? No. Not especially not in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I've found out is that you can't outdo anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Someone over here is saying to themselves or to their partner, I was drinking when I was 8. Like, okay, mate. Okay. Who cares? There's this one woman speaker. Tammy will know this person. She gives a great talk. However, her whole pitch surrounds the fact that she was drunk and high in her addicted mother's womb. In the womb. Okay, Teresa, you win. You win. You can't beat that. So don't even try. Now, I drank from age 13 to 33, 20 years. and now I've been sober for 20 years. Now, I had a good time for the vast majority of that drinking. It's only my mid to late 20s everything shifted and changed and turned on me. But for the most time, I had a great time. I was the leader of our pack. I was good at drinking and doing some other stuff. Now, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to talk about alcoholism. But I did try cocaine once for 20 years. I love that shit. I love amphetamines. I love anything that will allow me to drink you under the table, right? And so I'm having a good time for most of the time. Now, some people don't like the fact that if some of us have had a good time. They just don't like it. It's like, don't worry, mate. I am going to ruin my life and then want to kill myself. We're going to get there. But I had a good time. I'm sorry if you didn't have a good time. But then everything started to shift when I was age 25. After college and university, I became an entrepreneur with my brother. He was a brilliant businessman, and I was a good, like you, I'm a good bullshitter. Let's call him the marketing man. The businessman and the marketing man, and we made great joint forces. And we used to rent vehicles out to people involved in non-fault road traffic accidents. And every time a check would come in, we'd buy another vehicle, then we'd get a secretary. Before we knew it, within 2 years, we had outstanding invoices of almost $2 million. We had dozens of people working for us and a fleet of 60 or 70 cars. I had arrived. You know, the bankers watch with amused skepticism. I've whirled some fat checks in and out of his account. But alcoholism starts to creep in at this stage of my drinking. Now, alcoholism doesn't come in the form of me waking up with a big bushy beard, you know, drinking out of a brown paper bag. Alcoholism is subtle and progressive. And it seems to come, first of all, in the form of massive amounts of anxiety. Isn't that the worst? And it comes in the form of massive amounts of depression. And it comes in the form of this spiritual illness that wants to eat me alive from the inside out. It's killing my soul, which is ever becoming blacker, and soon it will become ash. And it's over a period of time. Now, the only time I feel good in my later 20s, when alcoholism is killing me during the day, is when I'm drinking at night time, because it's still working. When I'm drinking at night time, I'm all right. You put enough and a couple of pints in me, maybe a line or something, I'm like a mixture between James Bond, Dave Chappelle, and Harry freaking Potter. We're going to have a good time, right? We're going to have a good time. But during the day, I can't get out of my sports car because I'm paralyzed with fear. I can't get out of my car to go to a high-powered business meeting that I'd set up the day before. I didn't know that was alcoholism. I thought something weird is happening to me. Am I having mental health issues like my brother? What's going on with me? I just don't understand it. The best description I can give alcoholism is that something weird is happening to me. It was almost like, Darren, you've had so much fun. Let's see if you can handle this. And everything started to shift. And over the next couple of years, I'd be thinking to myself, I really, you know, at this stage of my drinking, I started to hate people, generally speaking, but I especially hated those happy folks. How can you be happy? It doesn't make any sense. And not only that, why are you happy and I'm not? And I hated that. And I'm like, and you know, then I'd be out at night with the false bravado, the drunkenly happy, but then during the day, I'd watch someone like laughing, the belly laugh, and I'm like, when's the last time I was really feeling like that? And so alcoholism steals your happy gene, and we don't even know it until it's too late. And as time goes on, I'm always in trouble. Now, I was the boss. I got away with a lot of stuff because I was one of the bosses, but my brother was onto me. We always have somebody who's onto us. Oh, my God. He was like a dog with a bone. And I couldn't turn up to these business meetings. Finally, he was sick of it. He was sick of my BS. And we used to have a director's meeting. We were a shareholding company. We'd have once a month. I would hate these meetings. And we're in this meeting, and I wasn't paying attention until I heard him say, so yes, Darren, we had a meeting before this meeting, and we've decided to let you go. And I wake up. I'm like, wait, what? Can you even do that? I thought I started this business with you. Only an alcoholic can pull that off, getting fired from a business you created. And I knew he's a brilliant businessman. I knew he'd have signed and sealed and it's a done deal. So my fear turned into anger like it does for us. and I saw red, and I kicked the table out of the way to go and give him a flying headbutt, right? Right, Pat? Well, I believe in clear communication. You know what I mean? I get tackled by the finance director. Just one of those awful scenes where the mask has slipped and Darren's been completely found out. My brother knew there was something up with me. And so it was a Thursday evening. Now, all I cared about, like any good alcoholic, is changing the narrative. I got to change the story. I've got to get ahead of the story and change it before it gets to other people. You can't be talking poorly about me. And I'm already spinning my way. I had to leave my sports car there. They're going to cut me a crappy check in a few weeks. And I'm thinking, who was in that meeting? There's only three other people. There's my brother. He's a wanker anyway. There's the finance director and the computer guru. I can talk. I can get away with that. So it's a Thursday night and I walk off home. It's the most miserable day of my life to that date. Now, was anybody else's weekend longer than their week? Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday was my weekend. So it was a Thursday night. I got home, I got changed. I went to the bar, I went to the pub in Manchester before my friends got there. I had a couple of stiff drinks and woof, the old fierce determination to win came right back. And here comes my mate Simon, and here comes my mate Dave. And I said, did you hear about that bullshit today? Did you hear about my brother's a wanker, dude. I built that business up from my bedroom. And they're nodding their heads and they're buying it. I said, I can do anything I put my mind to. And then by this time I'd had another drink. 15 of the other boys had come in, and now I've got an audience telling them everything that I needed them to know. And we're having a good old time again. Yeah, again, Darren's at the top of his game, drunk. And I said to them all, I said, hey, you know what I'm going to do? I don't need anybody, me. When I was a student, I used to love traveling. Oh, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go traveling again. In fact, I'm going to go to America. And I'm going to become president of America or some shit. Apparently anyone can become president over here, right? Now, I think the problem is the crappy UK weather. I think the problem is me brother. He's a wanker. I think the problem is me girlfriend. She keeps leaving me for stupid little things like my cheating on her. But no, somebody puts the problem onto a flight at Manchester International Airport and flies him all the way to LAX. And my uncle, who I'd never met before, had been living in Santa Barbara for 20 years. I came in the year 2000. In 1980, he moved over there. Now, he comes to pick me up. He lights up a big old spliff and passes it to me in the car. First thing he says to me, Darren, welcome to America. I'm like, thank you very much. You know, I have arrived yet again. This man owns an English bar in downtown Santa Barbara on State Street. See, there is a God. All my thoughts of what's gone wrong in England, it's nothing to do with me. I'm not the problem. It was them. It was that place. So I came to America for a two-week holiday 24 years ago. I never made it back to England. I didn't know I was going to almost die of untreated alcoholism. I didn't know I was going to circle the drain of life. I just thought, I'm coming here to take the edge off, man. Instead of staying for 2 weeks, my visa waiver allowed me to stay for 90 days. So I stayed drunk for 90 days. We don't have a problem with staying drunk. Other people have a problem with it. The police don't seem to like it. Bosses definitely don't like it. Spouses don't like it. But I can stay drunk or drunk and high as long as you want. The real problem for us alcoholics is facing life sober. That's the real problem. So my lack of responsibilities are really going to mask my alcoholism. 3 months, I'm a daily drinker already. A friend from England flies out. I buy an SUV. We travel the whole of America for 5 months. The whole of America. Trip of a lifetime. 12,000 miles, 32 states. I'm drunk off my ass in every little town, city and state. By the time we get back to Santa Barbara, I almost killed my friend, but by the way we were drinking. By the time we got back to Santa Barbara, I had 7 outstanding warrants in 5 different states. That means we had a good time. We had a good time. My friend, who's normal, flew back to England. England still has a black cloud over it for me. I said, nah, screw it. I'm staying here, man. I'm staying here, but now I've got no income. No money. And my uncle says to me, why don't you become a bartender? It was the best job in the world and the worst job in the world, all rolled into one. He had no idea what he's letting himself in for. Oh my God. I should have been fired after my first shift. My first shift. I would always be the drunkest person in the pub. Whether it was whether I was the bartender or not. And I didn't understand it because I'm waking up so hungover. We go to work sometimes so hungover that most normal people would dial 911. And as a bartender, in that scene, we're all covering for each other. We're all doing the white goods to try and liven ourselves up. We're switching shifts. We're doing everything we can because sometimes I just can't bear to go. And I would want to go downtown and get drunk all over again. It used to take me one full day to recover to then feel normal the next day. Do you remember that? Now those days were over. It was going to take me days to catch up and feel something like normal. Like, I drank so much hard alcohol, I've done so many drugs, I've ruined me wiring. Or I've cracked me mind. And only you lot will understand that. You've cracked me mind, we're operating at a different level and I need it dumbing down, like, immediately. And you know, a typical day for me, I would wake up, I would come to, and I would already be in trouble. I don't know what I'm in trouble for. I'm like, I just woke up, how am I in trouble? I don't know what I'm in trouble for, but I'm definitely in trouble. And for 18 months, the book says we stood at the turning point. I freaking lived at the turning point for 18 months, hanging on by a thread. Hanging on by a thread with that sense of impending doom. Now I know why we have a sense of impending doom. It's because something bad's going to happen. The way we're living our lives, right? I used to come to sweating and shaking. There's a bottle of Jägermeister coming out of every pore. And I'd sat on the end of the bed like, oh my God, what is wrong with me? I used to be somebody. I used to be an entrepreneur. Other people I was responsible for them, never mind just myself. I couldn't understand it. I knew my life had changed forever. I knew I couldn't do anything without having a little drink. And I even screwed that up. I know I can never be another normal member of society again. And then now I've got to go to work. Oh my God, it's Wednesday. Please let it be a day off. It's Wednesday. Now I'd have to go down. I'd have to jump in the shower, get on my bike, and bomb it down to Dargan's Irish pub to have a cheeky drink, to then go across the street to go to my English pub and go to work. And I think that's logical. I think I'm doing my boss a favor by doing that. Eventually the day came. I came to one morning. I had a shadowy recollection. Was I even working last night? Trying to put it together. I had a shadowy recollection of me being slumped on the stool in the corner of the bar, and I'm the barman, watching the other locals serving each other in the pub, giving each other money and stuff. And I'm thinking, this ain't right, man. And I came to, I've got 6 missed calls, all from the boss. I answer the next one. Get down here now. Oh, God, that sense of impending doom. Darren had been found out, completely found out yet again. The mask has slipped. This was 10 times worse than losing my entrepreneurial position in the UK. I go down to that bar and he is furious. He's got the owner of Dargan sat there as a witness. I said, hey, Raf, please, please don't fire me. I know, I'll never do it again. Darren, you'll never work in this bar ever again. I don't know what's wrong with you, but something's badly wrong with you. You should have been fired a year ago. I've been talking it with my missus and we've given you chance after chance after chance. I said, please don't do it. He said, you're done. You're gone. You need to go to England. You need to go to rehab. You need to do something. Oh, I went out and I tied one on that day, I'll tell you. The drunk of all drunks. I came to the next morning. I went down to my pub to see who took my shift. And I threw a pint over him in front of everybody. How to ostracize yourself from the whole downtown scene in a nanosecond. Only we can pull something like that off, right? Darren, you get out of here right now. We never want to see you ever again. And I went out and I went on a death march. It took me less than a month to get barred from every pub in downtown State Street. O'Malley's, James Joyce, Old King's Road. The Sportsman is very difficult to get barred from. We managed that as well. Now I'm just like living to drink. I haven't seen anybody for months and months and months. And a typical day for me, I would come to and it would be pitch black outside. And I have no idea whether it's night or day. And I would figure it out, oh my God, it's 5 a.m., that darkest hour before the dawn. Now I have strong, horrible, warm vodka under my bed because I'm going to need it at first daylight. But I so desperately don't want to drink it because I know what that means. But I can only deliberate and wait for 10 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes of just take a drink. It'll fix you immediately, but then you're immediately screwed. Just tough it out. You'll be all right. The cracked mind, the suicidal thoughts. And after 10 minutes, I would pull that bottle up and I'm drinking from tall bottles of vodka. And I always have four fingers left in the bottom of it. Because it's like a science project. That is exactly what I'll need at first daylight. And I would drink that down and empty that bottle. And it's not even 6 a.m., but here's the problem. I've just fed the beast, and now the beast needs feeding. And I would have to put on my smelly, baggy clothing to go less than one block to Foodland liquor store round the corner from my house to steal my two big bottles of vodka. And I'd go clinking off home. And one time, I was going to Foodland. I caught my reflection in a huge shop front window. It was so outrageous, I came back to have a look at it like, oh my God. I go right up to the window. I got a big bushy beard. My hair is stuck to my head and matted down everywhere. I'm very underweight. I'm sunken down. I'm yellow with jaundice. I look 15 years older than I should have. And I went up to my reflection and I said to myself, wow, I better not tell anyone about that, and carried on to Foodland. I steal me two bottles of vodka, go clinking off home. Now, what you want to do is go home and pound the vodka and pass out to obliterate the memory. But you can't do that. No, 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 no. It's like a science project. It is immensely important that first bottle gets nursed into the early, later afternoon. Because the second bottle has to get me into the evening. And I have to save enough. I'm trying to get to 10 o'clock, maybe even 11 o'clock at night for once, to maybe catch a good enough sleep and wake up and not have to drink like that ever again. And it says the mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. I drank like that for 2 more years. 2 more years of jails, institutions, and death. And then I started to come to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous drunk. Death, you can't scare us with death at this stage of drinking. Bring it on, man. But alcoholism doesn't have the dignity to take us quickly. I'm not talking about a fentanyl overdose. Alcoholism could mess with you for years, if not decades. My fear is not dying an alcoholic death. My fear is living an alcoholic life, one miserable day at a time. And here's how I got sober. I came to one morning and there was no vodka under my bed. And that had never, ever happened to me before. And so I took it as a sign, this is the day I'm going to kill myself. Now, I was fine with that. I tried to kill myself 3 months before that. 3 months prior, I'm at home, it's midnight, I'm maudlin drunk. The three roommates are downtown again. And I remembered one of them has an arsenal of weapons. And so I jimmied the door, I broke into his bedroom. Guns are everywhere. I found an AK, a shotgun, loaded revolvers. Now, I'm English, I don't quite know what I'm doing with a gun. But I went staggering into the living room. I sat on the couch. I put the gun in my mouth. It was cold, it was heavy on my teeth. And as I'm thinking, wait, do you blow the back of your head off or do you shoot up through the roof of your mouth? As I'm thinking it through, the thought came to me, hey, Darren, it's midnight. If you pull the trigger right now, you'll definitely wake the neighbours up. You know what I mean? I'm too polite for that shit. So I just throw the gun back in, finish the job. But today's the day I'm going to do it. I'm sober as a judge. I spend a couple of hours in my bedroom deliberating how to do it. I decide to throw myself off Santa Barbara's biggest bridge. Cold Springs Bridge, popular suicide spot in my area, off the 154. So I go outside about 10 a.m. I jump, my car is there, thank goodness. I could never find my car half the time. I get in my car, I drive 25 minutes up the mountain road. I park the car, I walk to the center of the bridge, and I pause because I know it's going to kill me mum. And in that pause, grace came in the form of a man in Alcoholics Anonymous who told me the truth. I used to share sometimes inappropriately. I used to share, I'm going to kill myself. I used to share, this thing doesn't work. And he pulled me off to the side and said, what are you talking about, Darren? What are you on? What are you talking about? This thing doesn't work. You can't say it doesn't work. You haven't done nothing around here. And I got angry because he's telling me the truth. I said, I've been coming here for a year, old man. He said, well, Darren, first of all, you should come sober. It works better. I had to concede that point. He said, and a drunk like you, you need to get a sponsor. You need to work the 12 steps and have a spiritual awakening or a psychic change. And I'm thinking it through on the bridge like, he's right. I had two big secrets in Alcoholics Anonymous, just like some of you have the two big secrets. One was I didn't have a sponsor. And if I did, it was in name only, which is the same nonsense. And the other one is I wasn't working any steps, and you lot were always talking about the steps. And so I made a decision on the bridge. I said to myself, okay, I'm going to go back to that AA BS, and I'm going to do those stupid 12 steps. And when they don't work, I'm going to go and find that man. We're going to have a little chit-chat. I'll probably take him off the bridge with me, right? Now, I know enough about my trying to get sober at this stage of my illness and alcoholism. I know that I can't just come skipping back to the rooms. I need to be once again medically detoxed in the lockdown psychiatric unit. Anybody else familiar with those places? I'd already been there three times, and it was only April. So I drive back down the mountain road. I go to Santa Barbara Cottage Hospital emergency room, and I park in my usual spot. I'd been there for... And as I'm parking, I sideswipe the car next to me. I can't believe I crashed in the car park at the hospital. I've just driven down a bloody mountain road for 20 minutes. The police are around the corner. They come over to me. I get out of the car. It's about 11 a.m. now. I say, I'm so sorry. That's my car. I've got my ID. I need to go into the hospital. One cop comes behind me. The other one comes right up to me, and then he smells me. And he goes, whoa, have you been drinking? I said, no, sir, I have not been drinking. Now, that's a weird first question. He said, you reek of alcohol. I said, I don't know what to tell you. He said, you're doing some field sobriety tests. I said, okay. I do 25 minutes of his field sobriety tests perfectly. He's so mad. He looks at his colleague. His colleague goes like this. He makes me do 15 more minutes. Then he makes me blow into his breathalyzer because I do them 15 minutes perfectly as well. I blow into his little device and I blow a 0.32. I haven't even had a drink yet. I'm waking up at a 0.32, then I'm drinking my two big bottles of vodka. The tolerance level is outrageous. I feel like I'm sober as a judge. These two cops just cannot believe it. They cannot believe the numbers I just blew. And they're jibber-jabbering with each other, and I'm like, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Ah. And then I see him come towards me, and he takes the handcuffs out, and I start to panic. Whoa, what are you doing? Like, have you ever detoxed in jail? Oh, my Lord. He said, turn around, you're going to jail. I said, listen, man, dude, listen. If you take me to jail right now, I will kill somebody. I said, I'm small, mate, but I am dangerous, let me tell you. Then I start to use the language of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I start to tell the truth. And the miracle starts to happen right away. Right away, I start to engage him like, look, I'm telling him all about Alcoholics Anonymous, that I've never really had a sponsor. I said, you have to let me into the lockdown psychiatric unit, sir. They love me in there. They got a file on me and everything. Now, of course, they arrest me, but they decide not to take me to the local police station. And I'll always be forever grateful for that, because that sounded so much safer to me. So now I'm handcuffed in the back of the squad car. We're driving to the police station. They actually radio ahead to tell their colleagues with what's going on. They said, hey, we've got this Irishman, and he blew a 0.32. I said, I'm English, you moron. I get to the police station, they lock me up, they take some blood, the blood test goes higher. Everybody that worked in that police station came down to chit-chat with me, let me tell you. So I felt like I was sober as a judge. But now I'm starting to get the DTs, the anxiousness is creeping back in. So after about 3 hours, they take my fingerprint, 3 hours, somebody comes and gets me to take me back to the lockdown psychiatric unit. But it's like, so what? This will be the fourth time this year. And I've actually gotten drunk on the way home from there twice. Here's the difference. The difference is Darren has hit bottom. Now then, hitting bottom for me gets misrepresented in the rooms of AA a lot. Hitting bottom for me has become something very precise, and any of you sponsors will understand it. Hitting bottom is actually not your worst outside circumstance. It rarely is. Hitting bottom is when you ask somebody for help and follow through with all the directions. And I was about to prove it. Now, but first of all, I need to go to the lockdown psychiatric unit to be medically detoxed. All thoughts of sobriety go out the window when you go into the lockdown unit. Now, it sounds a little depressing, I suppose, the psychiatric unit, but I love me some lockdown psychiatric unit, man. You know why? Because a lot of narcotics are coming my way, dude. And I know the drill. What you do is you go in and a security guard takes you to a different elevator. They take you up to the fifth floor in the Santa Barbara one. They lock you in, click you in through a door. Then you're in no man's land for a minute. Then they buzz you through. And then you're in the lockdown unit one more time. And I know the drill. I know exactly what I need to do. You go and see the person behind the little window to get as many drugs as is humanly possible. And I went up to the window and I know her and she knows me. And I said, "Hello, Mary, how are you doing, my love? Did you have a nice Christmas?" "Mary, I'm going to need my usual cocktail, please. I would like 18 Valiums, 2 pints of Seroquel, whatever them pink things are up there, I'll have some of them as well. And for once, can I have the penthouse suite? Or if not, just give me my usual room." She's shaking her head, smiling away. Just gives me as many drugs as she's legally allowed to give me. I wolf the drugs down, all go down. 10 minutes later. Just 10 minutes later, the effect produced. Woof! Darren's loaded to the gills. Loaded to the gills, ready to start judging people again. 3 hours ago, I wanted to kill myself. Now I'm Lord of the Nut Ward. Now I need to find myself another victim. She takes my belt off me. She takes my laces off me, you know, so you don't hang yourself in this happy place. And back then you used to go to your room and change into a robe. Now that I'm in the lockdown psychiatric unit, I know exactly what I need to do. I know what you lot do when you're in the lockdown psychiatric unit. I have to go and find myself a little girlfriend in the lockdown psychiatric unit. Don't you lie to me. I know that's what you do. Now, where does everybody hang out? They all hang out in the day room, right? They're all in the TV room. So I'm wandering down the hallway, loaded to the gills, with my robe on. I open the door and bang it against the wall so everybody looks my way. It's the usual suspects. There's a girl. I'm like, "Look at all these losers. There's a girl over here banging her head against the wall. There's a guy over here drooling on himself." And then I see her. Oh my God, she's the love of my life. She's all on her own doing laps around the couch, all on her own. She got this black hair, the black hair, but it's all in front of her face. She's got unusually long arms. She's walking around the couch going, "Aah!" She looks like that girl out of the movie, The Ring or some shit. And I go sliding in there and grab her by the hand and we do laps together till we fall madly, crazily in love. Then they detox me from the alcohol by giving me all the drugs. Then they detox me from the drugs. And 13 days later, Darren's been missing again for 13 days. They pop me out sober one more time. So what? Even I can get sober, I just can't stay sober. I got out on a Wednesday afternoon and I did not take a drink, which is an absolute miracle that I'll be forever grateful for. I went to a very, very powerful men's stag called the Junkyard Dogs. There was 90 men outside this meeting hall, smoking fags and drinking coffee, having a good time. Dozens of them were properly armed with the facts about themselves and the illness. I went straight up to the first person, I didn't care, pushed people out of the way, said, "Hey Mike, I just got out today, dude. I said, I'm going to drink tonight, man. You know it. I know it. What do I need to do?" And he looked right at me and he said, "Wow, Darren, are you sober right now?" I said, "Yep." He'd barely seen me sober that whole year. He said, "Wow, normally we do some reading. I've seen you struggling this whole year. We might do some reading. We might go to the ABCs on page 60. He said, "Screw it." He said, "Let's get into action." He said, let's do a third step prayer right now. Listen, I don't pray. I definitely don't pray on my knees. I don't believe in religion and I hate God. I said, what do you mean, Mike, in front of these 90 men? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay. I said, okay, because the no had been beaten out of me. Darren wasn't too cool for school anymore. Darren was about to conform to the process. We did a third step prayer in front of everybody. We went into that meeting. I'll never forget that meeting because somebody had a grand mal alcoholic seizure in that meeting. It was disgusting watching him lock up over a 2-minute period and fall off his chair and almost die. It was horrible. I've had many grand mal seizures. I've just never seen one, you know what I mean? I go home from that meeting. That night, I wrote 100 names on my resentment inventory. 100. I passed out. I came to at 5 a.m. the next day, shaking and baking. I wrote 100. I wrote 100 more names that morning. It wasn't even 6 a.m. I was going to drink. I called this man. He answered the phone. He gave me my next column. And he saved my life. I can never repay this man. I called him 12 times that same day to finish all 3 inventories. I went to his house the next day and we did my fifth step. It took us 3.5 hours. 3.5 hours. He gave me a big hug. He's about to send me home for my hour of review. And he said, Darren, this is amazing. This has never happened to me before. I said, I'm glad you feel good, Mike. I feel like shit, dude. He's all, don't worry, trust in the process. The next day we did steps 6 and 7. Step 6 and 7. I don't understand steps 6 and 7. Nobody understands steps 6 and 7. Don't worry about it. But I had a lot of willingness and I had a lot of humility and I was desperate to move on. And so we did. The next day I did my 8th step. The 8th step, it was easy. I already had my list. I just had to transfer it, annoyingly transfer it to a new list. And then I added to my list. On my 5th and 6th day of sobriety, I went around Santa Barbara and made 21 amends. 21 amends all over town. I went to all the bars, all the shops, any women I'd shockingly treated, anybody and everybody. I made as many amends as was humanly possible. And I was rocketed into a 4th dimension. I was lit up like a Christmas tree. My little English heart filled up so much I thought it was going to burst. And everything made sense. Everything made sense. Oh my God, this is why Mark's so into Alcoholics Anonymous. This is why Tammy and Pat are going to all these meetings and speaking. They must experience this. And I'm like, oh my God, this is why half the people in AA are miserable as can be. It's because they're not doing the work. Like I wasn't doing the work beforehand. Then I had an epiphany. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. This is what you're calling God. And I understood because I saw, I felt, I believed. I felt so good. On day 7, I got up and I went to Foodland Liquor Store, less than 1 block away from me, and I asked to speak to the manager. I said, sir, my name's Darren. I live less than 1 block away from you. And I have to tell you, I've been a really bad drunk for a really long time. I've been stealing vodka from your store for well over a year. I said, I've added it up and it comes to $2,750. I said, I will never steal from you or anyone else ever again. I said, sir, it's Friday. I just started work 2 days ago for the first time in years. It's Friday. There's $25. I'll be back every Friday with $25 until I've paid that whole amount off and any interest you determine. I said, is there anything else I can do to make this right? And he looked at me and he said, wow. And I looked back at him and I said, wow. And I floated off to make some more financial amends because I couldn't believe how good it felt to give you your money back. I said to my sponsor, what's next? He said, oh my God, Darren, this is amazing. He said, steps 10 and 11. I said, 10 and 11, what's that? He said, yeah, I'll show you what to do right here, right now for step 10. To postpone the punishment of. He already knew I was a recovered alcoholic, even if I didn't. postpone the punishment of. Weren't you being punished your last few months or years of your drinking and using? He said, then I'll show you step 11, what to do in the morning and what to do at night to sandwich your day. 2 minutes of meditation, Darren, you're already praying your little English arse off. 2 minutes of meditation, I'll show you how to do it. 2 minutes to review your day at night. Thank God he gave me the full strength sobriety, full strength recovery. Thank God he gave me what I now call the guaranteed version of sobriety. Guaranteed. Now, it's not like I enjoy meditation. I dislike meditation just like most of you. But I can't leave anything out. I'm the worst drunk I've ever met. I can't leave anything out. You can't leave out a fifth step because you have ADHD, can you? No. I can't leave out a ninth step because I don't have enough time to do it in the mornings, can I? No. So I don't know when it became kind of okay to mismatch the 11th step with the meditation, whether you want to do it or not. I'm just glad he gave me the full strength deal. In fact, with meditation, for me, it's taken me 20 years to go from 2 minutes meditation to 10 minutes meditation. 20 years! But God loves him a little trier. God loves him a little bitty trier, let me tell you. My God is actually up there laughing his bearded ass off at me down here in the mornings doing my shitty prayer meditation. Laughing his ass off, he is saying, look at that little wanker down there. Look at that little English wanker doing his crappy prayer meditation, but he's giving it a good shot. So then he says, oh, you know what? You know what? Check. Give that little guy another day of sobriety. That's what my God's like. He doesn't care that I'm a potty mouth man from Manchester. He cares about my actions. He cares about my helping others, which I do relentlessly. Relentlessly. I'm telling you, steps 10 and 11 are the keys to the kingdom. Steps 10 and 11 are so simple, you won't do it. Isn't that the truth? What is wrong with us? I guess we're alcoholic. Only an alcoholic will burn his life to the ground to then come running to a 12-step program just to resist the 12 steps. What is wrong with us? I don't know, we're just wired wrong, right? But I am in. I am sold on the plan outlined in this book. Now, some of us are sicker than others, right? I'm not as sick as Pat, but I'm pretty sick, man. I have to work a very, very, very good program just to kind of feel okay, whether I'm at work or I'm at home. Like, some people can go to one speaker meeting a week. That's their routine, and they're good and giddy. You've got to feed your own soul around here, man. I got to feed my soul a lot. I have the malady bad. I'm a chronic alcoholic. I have to get up in the morning and do some real AA before I start my day to even have half a chance. I got to do everything. I got to be in the trenches. I got to sponsor people. I got to do H&I. I got to be of service. I got to do all this just to be another bozo on the bus. I sponsor so many men in Santa Barbara. I do so much AA. I should be the Dalai freaking Lama or some shit. But no, I do all that just to be another worker amongst workers. And why do we do this? I'll finish with this short story. Why do we do this? We do it because we've entered the world of the Spirit. Why do we do it? So we can get that full heart moment. You know when you've been to a great meeting and you leave that meeting and your heart's full. That's the payoff. When you're working with your sponsee and she or he's either getting it or they've done a fifth step or they've made their amends and they're catching fire. Full heart moment. We go home to our loved ones and they know there's something going on with us. That's the whole point to this. For the payoff, we've entered the world of the Spirit. I was speaking at a young person's conference 8 or 10 years ago. This conference was a YPOR event, Akipor. 3,000 young maniacs have taken over this Hilton complex in the Bay Area in San Jose near San Francisco. If you've never been to one of these things, they are so annoying and so electrifying, all rolled into one. You have to check them out. 3,000 maniacs. Many of them have ended up in the hospital because they've overdosed on Red Bull, right? But don't worry, they put them on a monster drip and they were just fine, right? Now, I'm the closeout speaker, so a lot of these little wankers have already gone home or they've been up all night partying. There's like 600 people left for me, the closeout Sunday speaker. And I'm on stage. There's about 5 minutes before we're going to do our thing. There's a girl sat next to me I've never met before. She's from LA. And everybody's looking at us. Everybody's waiting for us to do our thing. And she's texting on her phone. And I think that's super rude. But it's got absolutely nothing to do with me. So I get involved right away. What are you doing, like? What's going on? What's wrong? Now, she's having a problem with her sponsor in LA. We're in the Bay Area. She's texting a sponsor in LA. Her sponsor got sober 21 years previously. 19 of these men and women were in this co-ed sober treatment center, all trying to stay sober. Usual story, most people got drunk, some went to prison, some died, some relapsed and then got well again. The usual story, two of them stayed sober for 90 days while everyone else did their thing. 90 days sober, Matt moved to Maui, Hawaii, got plugged into AA, stayed sober, got married, raised a family, had two boys. He's got a 19-year-old boy and a 20-year-old boy. They're on mainland America going to school, but they are dying of alcoholism. The only main contact he still has is the girl he got sober with. So he desperately texts her. She texts a couple of her babies. One of them sat next to me and she said, well, can I give them your number? I need a male number. I said, of course you can. Give them my number. We give our talks. Everything goes great. The conference is over. Now I'm getting in my car. We're bombing it down the freeway to go home back to Santa Barbara. Now, when I speak out of town, I got to take my tough guys with me, my sponsees with me. You take the tough guys, you know, the tattooed up guys. You know, with tattoos on the neck. Well, you never know what's going to happen. You might run into some of them NA wankers, you know what I mean? So we're all in the car, we're driving down, and I remember to call this guy, and he's on speakerphone. It rings for a bit, he answers the phone. Hey Matt, my name's Darren, I was coming home from a conference, I was told to give you a call. And there's nothing on the other end, it's just silence. Then we realize this guy is crying. He's crying, and it's such a moment of humility, and he can't catch his breath, and it's like, oh my God, and I want to cry, but I can't because I'm with my tough guys, you know what I mean? And I look at the guy next to me and like, oh, wait a minute, are you fucking crying? Tattoos on his neck, this guy's crying, and I look in the rearview mirror behind me, I'm like, oh my God, are you not crying in the back? You got tattoos on your face, for God's sake. We're all crying. Eventually, this guy gathers himself. He says, Darren, I want to tell you something right away. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time, and I've never prayed for anything about myself. My only prayer has ever been, if my two boys need the hand of AA, please let it be there. I said, dude, I am in. I'm pretty well connected in many of the states, and if I'm not, I'll find someone who is. What's going on? Where are they? How can I be of help to you? He said, they both attend Santa Barbara City College. I said, I work at Santa Barbara City College. Wow. We have entered the world of the Spirit. I go back to Santa Barbara and I meet both those two young men. One of them becomes a proud member of the Junkyard Dogs and now he's living in LA, living his best life. The other one, dying of untreated alcoholism. Doesn't that sum up the yin and the yang of Alcoholics Anonymous? Somebody's doing great and somebody's sponsor's not doing so great. This is the greatest show on earth. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. If you want to get the best fulfillment and enjoyment out of this, start sponsoring a couple of people. You don't need a lot of people. You need one, maybe two sponsees. You need these little soap operas going on in your life. tragedy over here. And someone's pregnant over here and they're having a baby and they're loving life. Someone in here has gotten picked up by parole and they're back in jail. All these soap operas, you never have time to think about yourself. If you're new, I'll leave you with this. If you're new or you're not so new and you're struggling with God, religion might be for those people that are trying to avoid going to hell. Spirituality is for people that have been to hell. Yeah. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Yeah.
Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.